Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The Dow was down 9 of the last 10 days, having its worst week since March 2023. Gold, on the other hand, hit record highs. Crude is marching higher. And who knew cocoa could be this hot? Author of the second edition of When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash, Hilliard Macbeth, gives a good rundown of the state of Canadian real estate. He doesn't think extending mortgage amortization to 30 years is the solution to the Canadian housing crisis because of the extra money it will suck out of the pockets of new home buyers. He also wonders where all the copper will come from for the push to the electrification of everything. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Recycleco Director of Marketing, Tony Mitchell. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recycleco, making lithium ion last forever. Recycleco's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recycleco Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recycleco.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recycleco, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Ross, the stock market, let's say it's interesting right now.
Let's say it is. I mean, we're getting so used to 8 weeks up, 9 weeks up, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're getting things like the Dow Industrials down for 9 out of 10 days, having its worst week since March of 2023. Other indices rolling over and having pretty bad weeks. The S&P just getting back and kissing its 50-day average for the first time since we took off from the lows back in October the 31st. The NASDAQ, the triple Qs there, got a good sell signal on that one on the weekly charts here about 4 weeks ago. And it's just been slowly rolling over. And, you know, tops typically are not one-day events. They are things that occur, especially in indices. They take time to develop. Maybe on individual stocks where you get a spike up and that can be the end of the move, but not in the indices. Those tend to be, as I say, rolling affairs. Things like the NASDAQ has been the better part now of 6 weeks going nowhere. And if it starts to roll over through its support levels, which aren't too much below this week's lows, then I think it could gain a little bit of momentum. You know, we've been saying to keep your stops reasonably tight because each one of these stair steps up has got to maintain good support on their pullbacks. So make sure that you're not overstaying the welcome if you've been in there for months and months on this move.
Well, people always wonder, should I just hold on to this? Should I sell now, anticipating a bigger drop? Or can you tell right now?
No, well, I think in some of these indices, yes, you can tell. Things like the Dow, it's getting a little oversold right now, might get a little bit of a bounce. But, you know, we're at the point of the market. We've had the best 6 months of the year, quote unquote. So you would expect to see a deeper correction. And, you know, the levels that we would be looking at, be like 20 or 50 week moving averages, which are another 5% or 10% below here. So if you're not comfortable with that type of action, take some money off the table. If you are somebody who participates in the option market, then it's a good time to be selling some call options, taking some premium while the market continues to go through a consolidation and pullback. So that's there's a little bit of something for everybody right now.
What's happening with gold?
Big week in the gold market. It managed to push through 2,400 for the first time in history. This sort of on the coattails of the geopolitical tensions, Iran versus Israel. Are we going to see anything big over this weekend as far as conflicts, military conflicts? That's anybody knows. So because of that, you had a really good 2 or 3 day run in the gold market, but by the end of the week, $95 range on gold gave back all of the previous day's run. But overall, it's a week with reasonable action on the upside, but the daily action looks pretty rough. Interestingly, on the commitment of traders numbers, looking at those, both gold and silver, there was very, very little action in the speculative and commercial positions. You would expect that as we've been gaining momentum slowly here and stair-stepping up on the gold market, that you'd get a fair number of new participants in the market. But overall, I think it was the COT numbers on gold were down about 4,700 contracts on the net positions. Silver was pretty much unchanged. So you really have got a lot of people who are still sitting on the sidelines, not willing to get on this bandwagon. And clearly, there are people that I'm aware of who are, you know, just that way. They didn't get on board on the initial breakouts, and they've been afraid to step in as things have started to go. I think like the equity market coming off the October low, you will get minor corrections along the way, and you've got to be looking for those minor oversold opportunities to step into those markets.
On the cryptocurrency front, Bitcoin losing a big chunk along with Ethereum.
Yes, we had good corrections there, the better part of we were over 72,000 a month ago. We tested 72,000 again two more times, and we were really boxing ourselves in. On the low side, support has been at 61,000, then 64, and now 65,000. So the consolidation pattern that we're in could very easily lead to the next move on the upside. Typically, we've had on the weekly charts 10 good exponential runs on the upside in the last 10 years. And the 50-day moving average has become the support level after those moves. And in this case, we've come back close to that moving average twice. It now sits just around 64,000. So if next week we were to have a little bit of a blip and drop through that 64,000 and then make a turn, I'd be very interested in getting on board that one, because having tested the old highs, there is pretty good potential for this thing to come to life again.
Cocoa is super hot. You might burn your lips on this.
You know, just when you think things have run their course, things like cocoa, we had, I look at the COT commitment of traders numbers very regularly. And on cocoa, this has been running because of conditions down in West Africa. But we had a small pullback here at 8,000, the better part of 3 weeks ago. And we got a buy signal on our COT model that we have. And, you know, it's the kind of thing when you're up that far, I really question what the potential is. But the reality is when the specs start to trade against the position and the commercials don't, you want to get on board that trend. So here we are. We've gone, in a matter of 3 weeks, we've gone from 8,000 to 10,400. So this one, for all that it's overbought, it still has legs, and I would say unless it breaks below 9,000, you want to make sure that you're picking up all your chocolate goodies right now rather than waiting another few months.
What's going on with copper?
Copper's been one of the good, solid markets. That one has had the move that you would expect as far as the seasonal is concerned. We've been very happy with the action there. And at this point, the open interest there, we saw 22,000 net new positions in copper on this rally. So we've gone from, you know, $4, well, we were $3.70 back in February, paused at $4.12, and now we're up in the $4.30s. So this is one of the markets that's got steam behind it. Hopefully it gets a little bit of a correction. I would think not too big, but conditions that economically, if things are starting to pick up here, I wouldn't be surprised that you see it elsewhere. And, you know, when you see a good move in copper, then you tend to see another move as far as inflation is concerned. And, you know, we did see the CPI number this week back up. We'll get an annualized rate of 3.5%. So the probability of, numerous Fed rate cuts this year seem to be out the window. And so with that, you know, the bond market had a bad break into the middle of the week. We got down to 116 on the long bond. That for us is a really good support area. And if we start to see a reversal here back through 118.5 to 119, I think you can be pretty much assured that the bottom is in for bonds. At least an interim low. This was a good test of the Bollinger Bands. And, anything on the upside might have the potential to run until the summer. And, you know, our long-term model would be this good recovery in bonds followed by then another rolling top and an erosion as we move through the second half of the year. But from now to the summer, look for potential on the upside, and wait for the first signs of a reversal. Don't get on board too soon, but I think that's going to be one where you've got the opportunity to make a few dollars.
Apple has decided they're going to get out of the autonomous car business along with watches. They laid off over 600 people. But where is their new pivot? Where are they going now, Ross?
Well, they're going to your desktop. They're going back to the Mac. They want to put all this AI into the Mac and get you away from being up in the cloud. So, interesting action. You know, here we are. We had some good oversold signals the better part of what is it now? March the 8th. So signals there, didn't get any really good action out of it, but it has double bottomed around 167, 168, and looks as though it has the opportunity to move here. We've got, as I say, maybe a double bottom. This one, for all that it's been a laggard for most of the last year and a half, it can come back and surprise you. I've seen that many, many times in Apple. So, if there's one to be looking at, take one that like this that people have been stepping away from.
Well, Apple also announced it's working on a domestic robot, so Rosie from the Jetsons can become reality.
Well, put me in line for that one.
Ross, always fun chatting with you.
It was, Jim. Thank you.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Hilliard Macbeth, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
It's great to be back.
Hilliard, just taking a look at a release from the Canadian Real Estate Association, prices across the country down 0.3%, but we have hot spots. What are they? Where are they, and why?
Yeah, the big picture is that probably the peak in the housing market was hit in Toronto and Vancouver in 2021 or 2022, because it shows up on we publish every month around this time. We just published it a couple of days ago, the results going back quite a few years. And we get our stuff from, not from the CREA, but from Terranet National Bank. And it shows that there was a peak and then a dip and then another peak and then another dip. But it's generally the trend is down since about 2 years now, 2 or 3 years. And that kind of coincides when interest rates start to go up. And the big problems are in the suburbs of Toronto and some parts of Vancouver, especially the luxury high-rise condos. And we're still at this phase where the sellers are just reluctant to sell because they just can't stand the idea of, you know, say, take the Vancouver condo idea. At one point, some of them were getting close to $2,000 a square foot for their condo. And they just can't absorb mentally, they can't stand the idea of it going below $1,000 a foot for the condo. And there might not even be that many buyers, so is there any point in lowering the price? But in Calgary and Edmonton, the market is still pretty warm. I mean, it's not hot in the sense like it got hot in Vancouver and Toronto, but it's a lot warmer than the rest of the country. And that's probably because incomes are higher in Edmonton, Calgary, and people are moving to Alberta. You know, people are coming here for whatever reason, and everybody's got a different reason probably. But I do see the license plates from BC and even Ontario, which is pretty rare, driving around when you're out and about. So it's definitely a lot more affordable. The incomes are much higher in Alberta compared to Toronto and Vancouver, but of course that doesn't take into consideration the wealth that has been built up. And you know, some people with very high, large amounts of wealth in Toronto and Vancouver don't report much income. But in Edmonton, Calgary, it tends to be younger population, more two families working and making good incomes. But I just saw a report that even with the slight decline we've had in the last 2 years, Toronto, Vancouver, and Hamilton, which is basically a suburb of Toronto now, I guess, are all among the top 10 most unaffordable places to live in North America. And in fact, Vancouver and Toronto are both ahead of New York City and Manhattan. And that's crazy because I know that the incomes in Manhattan are much, much higher. There's a large amount of people in Manhattan that are earning in the millions of dollars a year. And there's a very tiny number of people like that in Toronto and Vancouver. So there's no comparison there. So it is a bubble, and it didn't burst when I thought it was going to burst, but that doesn't mean it won't burst. It just means that it's a delayed bursting. And, of course, the higher interest rates haven't worked their way through the system yet, but they're well on the way. Although the government of Canada is trying to make some changes to help people. Well, they're trying to help people, but my idea is they're not really helping them at all.
Right. I guess the biggest change from Ottawa, they're going to allow 30-year mortgages again.
Yeah, and they're even on existing, where this is for new buyers, and but on existing people that have, you know, basically, they never, my theory is they never actually got current
after that moratorium. I don't know if you remember, but there was a moratorium in 2020 after COVID hit and said, you don't have to pay your mortgage for 9 months. And then around a year later, when the banks were asked, they said, oh, yeah, we've got all our customers are back on track and stuff. And then about a year after that, so 2022, it came out that the variable rate mortgages, when interest rates went up, a lot of them were going into extended amortizations of 35, 40, 50 years. Even some of them were infinite amortizations. They weren't even paying the interest on their debt, much less paying down some of the principal. So that's been lingering since 2020, and now we're in 2024. And so the government is suggesting that they should be allowed to make that extended amortization, which they never really got back on the 25-year cycle, they should be allowed to make that permanent. But the problem with that is it's crazy because the only person that benefits, the only player in the whole game that benefits from that is the bank, the lender, because, of course, you're going to pay a lot more interest if you extend. Even extending your amortization out to 30 years from 25 years, there's a huge jump in the amount of interest you pay over the term. I don't have the exact numbers. I saw something today that said it's around, at current interest rates of 5%, it's around 50-50 at 30-year amortization. You pay 50% in interest, 50% in principal. So basically your home costs you double what you thought it was going to cost you. At 6.5%, even 25-year amortization, it's 50-50. So at 35 years, if rates go up to 6 or 7%, like they probably will, you're talking about way more interest that you're going to pay over 35 years than you would pay in principal. And who wins on that? The only entity that wins on that is the bank. They get more interest. But the risk of default goes up. So the bank it's not a clear-cut win for the bank because the longer you extend the amortization, the greater the chance that there might become a problem in the household. They might have trouble paying that debt back. So, whether it be illness or unemployment or divorce or whatever, there's lots of things that happen in people's lives. So, on surface, it looks better for the banks, but maybe in the long run, it's not so good. The other thing that they announced was for first-time buyers, they announced that they would be able to almost double their withdrawal from their RSPs, and they could buy with a longer amortization, which allows them to get a bigger loan when they buy the first time, which basically means it allows them to pay more interest over the lifetime of the loan with a longer amortization. And again, that actually is primarily aimed at helping some of the developers who are stuck at the moment having real difficulty selling some of these places because the younger people who buy most of the new housing, they can't qualify for the loans right now. So this, if they can figure out a way to help them qualify, they might be able to dump some of that inventory onto the young couples that are buying for the first time. But that's not going to help the young couples. It's going to help the developers. So, My feeling would be that it would be better to let the system shake itself out, let the developers go bankrupt if that's where they're headed. And, it's unfortunate because building costs went up so much. A lot of these projects, people put a down payment down, and it's a pre-construction condo, they call it, and the building costs went up as much as 80% over the following 2 years during the construction. So the developer can't raise prices by 80%, so they're going to be stuck with some big losses, and they may have to go bankrupt. But if that's what has to happen, let it happen. You know, it's like this: getting people deeper into debt is not going to solve the problem.
Do you have any ideas on what could help? Because apparently, Canada's short millions of homes.
Well, that's another whole topic, and. There's a lot of talk about needing these homes because there's so many people coming to Canada. But the thing is, almost all of the increase in people coming to Canada. So Canada's had a growth rate of 1 to 1.5% for many, many years, which is a little bit higher than most other countries. But a comparable country like the U.S., it's only slightly higher than the U.S. So what's happened recently, though, in the last couple of years, is a huge surge in temporary visitors. So these are people that come. There's three categories. There's refugees that ask for amnesty. There's students, and there's temporary permits to work. Say, like somebody comes to work in a nursing home or something on a 1 or 2 year, or maybe somebody comes to work at a ski hill like Whistler on a 1 or 2 year permit. And there's they subtract the number of people that leave at the end of those permits, and then they add the number of people that are come in on those permits. And if you take all of that out, it hasn't really changed that much. The, you know, without the huge increase in students and temporary foreign workers, the trend is about the same as it's been. So now the government's talking about a huge decrease in the number of permits that they're going to let for temporary foreign students and foreign workers. And that is going to hit really hard because those people are needed to work. And obviously the universities are going to be short of students that pay them really good tuition. So, but it's also going to ease up on the crisis, the so-called crisis in the shortage of homes. So I think it's exaggerated unless all of those people now, there is a way that it's not exaggerated, and that is if all those temporary people become permanent residents. And that when they move from temporary to permanent, they are now called immigrants. And unfortunately, all of the news stories that are published about it use the word immigrant, but that's a mistake because you're not an immigrant until you actually apply for permanent residence. And how many of them are going to apply for permanent residence? I don't know, but there's some suggestion that you know, many of them might not stay. They might go back or move on to another country, depending on the employment situation, and of course, depending on what happens at the end of their school time. So we don't know. It's a difficult thing, but Canada's been building homes at a very high rate compared to the U.S., much, much higher than the U.S. So I'm skeptical of those ideas that we're going to have a huge shortage of housing. I should add one more thing. A shortage there is a shortage of housing, but it's not overall shortage. There's quite a generous amount of housing. There's a shortage of affordable housing. That's the problem.
Yes. Well, you were mentioning nobody wants to build social housing or affordable housing because there's no profit in it.
There's very little profit. You know, the developer, if you think about it from the developer's point of view, it usually what happens is the developer spends in Vancouver, Toronto especially, but even around Edmonton and Calgary, the developer spends a very large amount of money on a plot of land, and then they look for opportunities to develop it. And sometimes it means working with the planning department of the city to get permission to build. And then they finally get permission, and this might take 5 or 10 years. So they've been sitting on this land and earning no interest. Hopefully the value of it goes up, but not necessarily. And then they finally get the opportunity to build on it. What are they going to want to build? They're going to want to build the structure that gives them the maximum amount of profit. So if they can build $200 million condos on there, $200 million of value, and get a 15% profit, that's $30 million. Well, of course, that's what they're going to want to do. They're not going to want to build affordable housing, which might be more in the $300,000 or $400,000 range, and the profit margin would be much skinnier. So the only way that, and so the government has done this thing, which is, it's not really working at all, where they say, you can get some help from the government if you set aside a minimum of 10 or 20% of the units as, I'm putting quotations about, if you can imagine quotation marks, air quotes, around the word affordable. Because all it is it has to be, I forget the percentage, but it's something like 20% cheaper than the other units in the building. Well, that's crazy. I mean, like, so in other words, a guy builds 200 units at $1 million a unit and sets aside maybe 20 units at $800,000 a unit, and he qualifies as an affordable. That's not the kind of thing that is needed. What's needed is a whole building of affordable, and many, many buildings, not just one, of affordable housing, where the rents can be, you know, under $2,000 a month for something that somebody can live in with a family, and then it's all good. But the only way that can happen is if the government gets involved. And the best place for the government to get involved is not in the construction phase of the thing, but in the land development phase. So the land, which the developer in the, you know, at the beginning, I said the developer paid a big chunk of money for the land. The land could be made available to the developers at a much cheaper rate if they agreed to build affordable housing. And there's all the cities have land that they can make available. They're just not willing to do it. And one of the reasons, I think, is that they get a lot of pressure from developers to not do it. So we had, I live in Edmonton, as you know, they shut down the municipal airport. It's a huge chunk of land. I forget how many acres. It's a huge amount of land. And it was supposed to be developed as for 30,000 housing units, and they were going to have a renewable energy angle to it. Well, only a tiny fraction of those units have been, I don't even know, it's 1,000 units. It might be only a few hundred units that have been developed. That was a perfect opportunity, and it's very close to downtown as well, so it would be a great location to do that, but it hasn't gone ahead. And, of course, if the city put all that land, started developing housing on all that land, what would happen is that would decrease the value of the plots of land that the developers own on the outskirts of the building, outskirts of the city, that they want to develop for more expensive housing. So that's probably why the city is stalled. I haven't seen anything written on, and I haven't asked anybody at the city why they haven't gone ahead with that development. They've also got another, in Edmonton, they got another land. They shut down, we built a new hockey rink close to downtown, and there's the old hockey rink and the exhibition lands, which is another huge plot of land, is just sitting there. Nothing's happening. So it's actually not that hard to do this. It's just a question of having the political will to make it work. But going all the way back to the 1980s, there was a problem. It started in England. And a politician named Margaret Thatcher got elected, and there had been a long period of government involvement in housing and mining and railways and all kinds of stuff. They owned an oil company, British Petroleum. They owned all kinds of stuff. And so she decided to privatize it all, and she, along with the help of a fellow named Milton Friedman from the University of Chicago, started a belief out there that only the private sector can solve these problems. And so it became, the mantra became, let the private sector do it. Well, the private sector is really good at some things, but affordable housing, the private sector is not good at. So now we're living, so that's 40 years now, 44 years since the Thatcher Revolution. And we've had very little affordable public housing built anywhere in the developed countries. And that's where we sit. So we got to get back into the business of doing that. I don't know. Does it sound like socialism? I don't know. It's not socialism. It's not capitalism. It's not communism. It's not Marxism. It's just something that we have to do, and we have to figure out how to do it, because whatever it is we're doing now is not working.
Well, in Canada in 92, both the federal Liberals and Conservatives agreed that Ottawa would no longer be in the social housing business. And I don't recall having to step over a person sleeping in a doorway before 1992. And all of a sudden, we have homeless people.
Well, and the homeless people is just it's sort of like that tiny bit of the iceberg that's across above the water, and the 90% is below the water, because the other 90% are young families. And especially with this huge surge in immigration, some of the temporary residents are going to stay. They have bigger families if they're younger, and they don't have a place. Like, if you've got four kids, try and go rent a place in Edmonton, Calgary, Vancouver, or Toronto. First of all, you probably can't even get a place. And secondly, if you could get a place, the cost would be much too high. So we're saddling all these people that we actually want to encourage to come to Canada, and we want to encourage young people to build families and all of that. And, but we're making it impossible for them to do it. So you have, people, you know, older people living in luxury condos, and they can afford it, and no place for the rest of the people to live. And it's crazy. So they tried in the past different ways to do incentives for the private sector to, you know, do more affordable housing. But none of them have worked because they don't want to give up that valuable plot of land that they maybe have, you know, sat on for 10 years or 15 or 20 years to put it into a government housing project. It's not, that isn't their first or second or third choice. So I don't know how you do it. I think most cities have quite a bit of land that they could contribute to this project. It's just a question of, there's going to be some major pushback from certain, powerful interests against it. But, I think it has to be done.
Commercial real estate, has that hit the bubble and is bursting?
The bursting in the bubble I've asked as soon as from before my first book came out about the bursting in the bubble. Of course, people wanted to know when, and then also they wanted to know, how do you know the bubble has burst? And so we talked about 40%, 50%, somewhere in that range. You know, that's what happened in the official numbers in the U.S. The housing market, the housing bubble in the U.S. in 2006, 2007. By 2010, it had dropped 38%. So that's probably a good indicator where the bubble starts. But the commercial real estate, especially office, now the problem with saying commercial is there's all kinds of, there's the shopping centers, there's the office towers, there's an industrial space, and there's warehouse storage and all that, and they're all different. They all operate on different cycles than that. But the one that really stands out is the high-rise office tower, and some phenomenal numbers have just come out in the last week. And I can't remember the American cities, things like a $250 million office tower that sold for $3.5 million. Well, that is like an unbelievable number because it would cost more than $3.5 million to just demolish that building. And then you'd have a nice plot of land, probably right near the center of the city, if anybody wants land near the center of the city anymore. So that's basically, the buyers getting it for really cheap. And, so obviously these buildings, of course, they're not very well occupied. Some of them have like 50% occupied. And they're probably not even 50% occupied if you dig in the details, because there's leases that are coming up for maturity and the person that's using the space doesn't want to renew it at the same amount of, they want to take less space and that sort of thing. So, you'd have to look, but even places like Toronto have got 16% office vacancy. And of course, Edmonton, Calgary are much higher than that. It's definitely the bubble is bursting. And now a lot of people don't want, it's interesting, you know, a lot of people don't want these numbers, like going from 200 million down to less than 5 million. They don't want these numbers published because the problem they have is that they've got the financing against some of these, their holdings. And now they have to really struggle to the auditor's going to say, well, how come you're still holding that building at $200 million on the balance sheet when one similar to it just sold for less than $10 million? And so that's the problem. And so that's why you haven't seen very many public. And, you know, I've been watching fairly closely, and it's only recently that these things have started up. A few months ago, a great big company, a Canadian company called Brookfield, they defaulted on a couple of buildings in Los Angeles. Prime, the top buildings, and Brookfield tends to only own the top office buildings in any city that they go into. And Los Angeles, they own two of the most desirable office towers, and they defaulted on them. So the way it works in that business is you can walk away. Unlike a house in Canada, you can't walk away. But in that business, you can walk away, and all the lender can't come after Brookfield for the deficit. The lender now owns the building, and that's their remedy. They get to take over ownership of the building if Brookfield defaults. So Brookfield just stops making the payments on the loan, and the lender, after a few months, so maybe some legal papers exchanged, ends up owning the building. So And but the debt on those buildings maybe was 50, 60, 70% at the most, probably so they're basically the Brookfield's walking away from the equity in the building. But even that 50%, let's say it was 50%, if it was $200 million building, now the debt is $100 million. So now the lenders got it for the equivalent of $100 million by taking it over, but maybe that's still far too high. So that's definitely a crash, a bursting of a bubble. Anything over, say, 40% would be considered a crash, especially when it was pretty universal, the view that real estate prices always go up, they never go down. And when people say that, they don't mean just housing. They mean in general real estate, you know, hotels, office towers, shopping malls, and all that. And gradually, one by one, the shopping malls, of course, they went down in value quite a few years ago. Now the office towers are going. Hotels are still pretty good, I think. And then, of course, the residential real estate has held on really well because they got a lot of individual buyers out there who are getting mortgages from the lenders and going in and putting their down payment down, and a lot of government rules that allow them to borrow a large amount of money, probably way more than they should be borrowing, to keep that that game going. But I think eventually it'll hit the residential market as well.
Vancouver had a shortage of warehouse space around the port. Is that still a hot market?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's the hottest thing that you hear about right now is artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And of course, that the way people are playing that is with the chips, and so there's very powerful computer chips that allow artificial intelligence to develop. And the number one company in the world is NVIDIA, and so that's been around for a few months. And everybody has to make an announcement. Apple just announced this is really funny, actually. Apple just announced that they're going to have a whole new range of computers brought out with new chips that'll allow them to go after artificial intelligence. And the stock jumped like 3 or 4% just on the, just putting artificial intelligence in the title of the news release. And but of course that's kind of exaggerated. And but then so now that was 3 or 4 months ago. Now the thing is they're talking about these servers, and they say, okay, the data servers, that's the server farms as they call them, they need to be expanded dramatically because you got two things. You got AI and now you've got electrification. You've got this electrification of society as the energy transition heats up. And we're going to need way more data centers than we used to have. And that's a new thing. So the biggest player in that field was Amazon. Amazon got into it early on when they were selling books online. And they built excess capacity in these data centers. And then now everybody's scrambling for data centers. So, and also logistics like delivery, like, you punch the buy button and about 5 minutes later it shows up on your front doorstep. It's kind of like, how did they do that? You know, and so they got to have a warehouse near to your house, I guess, to pull that off. So that's a hot area. But I would think that the hottest areas are going to be more likely to be in things like artificial intelligence and not in buildings. Buildings are kind of, you know, you don't really need a huge building for artificial intelligence. That chip that NVIDIA announced a couple of weeks ago, the new one, is something like 10 times more powerful than the one that they were selling up until just then. And now it's not out yet. I think it's a few months or a year away before you can buy it. But everybody's going to wait to buy that one, and they're not going to buy the old A100 chips. They're going to want the new one. And so the power that's being packed into these things is so much greater than anything that's ever happened before. They won't need as much space. I think the era having... Yeah, I think about these high-rise, going back to your original question about the commercial real estate and the high-rise office towers, you know, a lot of that space was required because you had floor after floor after floor of hundreds of clerks on each floor doing the manual work or keeping up the balance sheet of the company or doing the invoicing, sending out different mailing items and that sort of thing. And none of that happens anymore. You know, people don't even need a tiny, tiny fraction of the number of people that they used to have. And so you don't need space for it. And then the rest of the people that you do need, a lot of them want to work from home. So it's kind of like, wow. So, I don't think it's going to be a shortage of buildings and space. I think it's going to be more a shortage of electrical power, because all of these things need electrical power. AI needs electrical power even more than Bitcoin farming. And the electrical power thing, that's where the real shortages are developing. And, of course, the way to play that is with commodities like copper and lithium and that sort of thing, which is another whole story.
Well, what is the story of copper? Does Canada have a lot of it?
Canada has a lot of copper. Canadians don't necessarily own the mines anymore, but some of the mines are here. Canada has a lot of nickel. It's owned mostly by a Brazilian company called Vale. It used to be Inco. Used to be the biggest nickel company in the world. But that's changing very rapidly. And copper, the thing about copper is it's kind of like people talk about nickel and they talk about different lithium and different elements. But copper is interesting because an electric car has a lot more copper in it than a regular car, mostly because of the battery, but also because not so much of the battery. That's the lithium.
It's the motors.
But it's the motors. The motors are a huge portion. Like most of these cars now have... I have two motors. My Tesla has three motors, and some of them have one motor, but I think most it'll settle in around two or three motors. Some of them might even have four motors, one for each wheel. And there's a huge amount of copper in those motors. But then you think about all the connectors too. Like there's a huge backlog of connection points to the grid. From all the new solar and wind and battery storage that's being built in the U.S., it's an enormous amount. And the wait now is out to 2 or 3 years to get your project connected to the grid. And they're going to have to fix that. And that requires a lot of copper because those electric wires usually have copper in them and sometimes a lot of copper depending on the voltage.
So, yeah, Hilliard, the hard numbers here. An electric vehicle uses 277% more copper than an ICE vehicle. That's 183 pounds or 83 kilos.
Yeah, and that's...
That's a lot.
So on top of that, there's a Canadian company called First Quantum that has a really good copper mine in Panama. And the government just forced them to shut it down because there was a dispute over who's going to... The profits out of this mine are going to be enormous. And... the government said, we want a bigger share of the profits, and they couldn't agree. And now the thing's been shut down for several months. So that's 400,000 tons a year of copper production that's been taken off the market. So that's the sort of thing that obviously that'll come back on the market, although the share price of First Quantum doesn't reflect it yet. But I think eventually it'll come back on again. Probably the reason the share price hasn't gone back up that much is because to get it back on, they might have to give up a big share of the ownership of it to the government of Panama. But Zambia's got a huge amount of copper. Indonesia is now the world leader in nickel by far. And of course, all of these materials seem to end up in China to be refined. that's the thing. And here we are, in Canada, we're, you know, amending the rules of whether your mortars can be 30 years or 35 years. And it's crazy. I mean, it's just we need to get going really faster. But part of the problem with mining in Canada is I'm sure if the copper price goes up, like it probably will, there's a whole bunch more copper mines that even the mining companies know their ore bodies there, but they couldn't develop it at the costs. Because the price wasn't low enough. But now, if a higher price is there and they guaranteed that it'll stay up there for a while, they can go ahead and apply for approval. But the problem in Canada is the approval process is so long, and it's very, very difficult. Now you've got provincial, you've got federal, you get environmental, you got you got indigenous claims. It's just a lot of these mines are in BC, and some of them are in Northern Ontario, a lot of them are in Quebec. So there maybe needs to be some kind of a special effort made to fast track some of these developments and get this thing going. Otherwise, we're at the risk of being left behind in Canada.
Well, I know climate change is a big topic, but I saw two reports that said the country that will benefit the most from a warmer climate is Canada, basically because the ice fields retreat and all of these minerals are exposed that you can now use.
Yes, but the problem with that is that that all of our fresh water comes from the ice fields. I was just shocked to find out that glaciers and ice fields is where almost all the fresh water in the world are stored. Like in the lakes and the rivers have almost no amount of fresh water, and the groundwater, although in Canada the groundwater might be a little bit more available for a little while longer, in most of the parts of North America south of us, the groundwater is basically depleted. So if the glaciers retreat, we'll have all these minerals, but we won't have any fresh water for the workers to drink. Plus, a lot of these mining operations, they need water. They need a large amount of water. Agriculture needs a lot. Beef cattle needs huge amounts of water. So we need to make sure that can you do anything about it? I don't know if you could do anything about glaciers melting, but it's a bit of a concern that if it warms. And Northern Canada, there's a huge space in Northern Canada where almost nobody lives. And there's lots of fresh water up there in the lakes. So that may be an area where we might all end up moving to extend a nice life for a few more years, a few more decades. But there's a lot of changes coming, and they're coming very rapidly. And I think the bet that electrification of everything is going to go ahead faster than people think is a pretty good bet. And if people want to invest in that, of course they should be careful to diversify, because there's always surprises like that. Like those guys in First Quantum thought they had a really good deal in Panama, except the government canceled their lease, right? So that's why you have to diversify and make sure you got at least 10 or 15 or 20 different projects that you own, so that you don't get shocked by any one particular event, unforeseen event like
well,
that.
Well, your Danielle Smith, the premier of Alberta, is an unpredictable event, canceling wind turbine and solar projects.
Yeah, well, she's allowing them now, but the moratorium ended in March, I think. She put a six-month moratorium on it. I think it was 6 months. Now the new rules are out, and there's a 35 square kilometer buffer, so you can have a view of a bunch of pump jacks pumping oil, but you're not allowed to have a view of a single wind turbine in that 35, and definitely no solar panels, right? So it's pretty interesting to compare Alberta and Texas, because Texas is going ahead. Texas has the most rapid development of winds, solar, and battery storage, and like utility scale battery storage of anywhere in North America. But they're also the biggest producer of oil with the shale oil in West Texas. So they seem to be able to, and a very right-wing government in Texas, there's no doubt it's a very right-wing government, but they seem to be able to handle the two at the same time. But in Alberta, we're kind of stuck thinking that oil and gas is going to be around forever, and try and slow down the transition to wind and solar as much as possible. And that's probably a mistake, but who knows? I mean, there's going to be an election at some point, and we'll see if what people think about that.
Well, Alberta is also not openly declared war on Ottawa, but they might as well. Now Danielle Smith is proposing a law that every federal program in Alberta has to go through a panel to see if it matches up with what Alberta wants. And the mayor of Calgary is totally upset about that because her city was about to benefit with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of federal help to improve housing in a city where she pointed out quite correctly that Calgary is the economic or the heart of Canada's economic engine. And all these people are flocking there to take advantage of that. But if they don't have enough housing, you're just put a bullet in Canada's economic heart.
Yeah, and you know it's interesting because the cities have benefited from some of these federal. You know, every time there's a big project, the federal government puts in a lot of money. The province puts in some amount of money, but less, and then a municipality puts in very little money because they have very little money. And sometimes they get lured into doing stuff that they shouldn't do, like. Because they look at the federal government dangles its money out and they say, we can't pass up on that. So they scramble around and try and do it and then they get in over their heads or whatever. But the federal government's always going to try and influence stuff in Alberta. And the likely opponent in the next election, if the NDP is the primary opposition in Alberta, which it probably will be, they're having a leadership race right now, and the former mayor of Calgary, Nenshi is his name, who's very popular in Calgary. I don't know how popular he'll be in the rest of Alberta, but he's very popular in Calgary. He's probably going to get the nomination for the NDP, and then so when the next election comes up, Danielle Smith will be going against him. So it'll be interesting if she can pull this off, but it's kind of like she's preaching to the choir with this federal government. The hate for Justin Trudeau and the hate for Ottawa is one thing, and it's always been a political advantage in Alberta to touch those heartstrings going back to Peter Lougheed and Pierre Trudeau. But Lougheed was smart enough to do it as a public. Kind of a way of stirring up the troops and, you know, kind of getting some emotions into it. But he never, ever went to the thing where he didn't, still cooperate with the other provinces and with the federal government. So the current premier, Daniel Smith, has taken it to another whole level, and I don't know if she's trying to separate from Canada or what she's trying to do, but it's a dangerous game that she's playing.
Well, there's also a movement in Alberta to become the 51st American state.
Yeah. You think Ottawa treated us badly? You can imagine how we get treated in the U.S. Our big problem, Alberta, one of the reasons that Alberta is so enamored with the U.S. is because we sell all our oil to the U.S., pretty much all of our oil to the U.S., and the U.S. has been an eager buyer of our oil, and so they've, the pipelines go south, and there's now a new pipeline that's been expanded that goes west. It's going to open up soon for 775,000 barrels. So it's a tripling of its size, the Trans Mountain. But there's 3.5 million barrels that go south every day. Most of it from the oil sands goes to different refineries in the U.S. So that's by far the biggest. But the problem is that the U.S. is now the biggest producer of oil in the world. They're even exporting. The U.S. has become a huge exporter of oil. So our main customer is the U.S. But they have found a whole bunch of oil in Texas, in the shale oil, and elsewhere, where they don't need our oil as much as they did before. So I don't know that we necessarily would be treated very well by. I think the U.S. might like to encourage us to break up Canada, because that would make their dealings with Canada easier. If they have different things they want to do, and they're things that Canada normally would oppose, but they might like our water, for example, but I don't think they really would do it to be nice to us. I think they to use us, you know. So I think we'd be better off to stay in Canada and you know, try and present a united front in any negotiations between the U.S. We're at a real disadvantage negotiating with the U.S. obviously, because they're so much more powerful than we are, so much bigger. For instance, one thing that nobody talks about, and I don't know when it's going to come into the news, if ever, but the Columbia River Water Sharing Treaty is coming up for renewal. I think it was a 50-year agreement, and it's actually expires in September of this year. Now there's like a 5-year period when it carries on. If there's no agreement at the end of the expiry, there's a several-year agreement. I know the committee has been meeting for several years now to resolve any issues that are outstanding, but that's going to be a big discussion because California, Nevada, especially Arizona, they are all desperate for water. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that all shakes out. So the stronger Canada is to represent as a united front against in the negotiations, the better chance we have of getting a good deal. But
well, China and Russia would love to see the U.S. have a civil war and split up into separate states, because individually they're much weaker than the United States.
Exactly. Yeah, the United States is the most powerful country in the world, partly because of their wealth, but a lot of it's because of their military might, you know. And but they've only got 5% of the world population. So Canada's got less than a tenth of that. So, or about a tenth of that. So 5.5% combined against some very large countries like China and India. So we should stick together, I think.
And for all of you Tesla lovers, a woman was trapped in her Tesla in 115 degree Fahrenheit heat during a computer update. She was locked inside her vehicle for 40 minutes because you need an active computer to open the doors.
Oh, my God. That doesn't sound right. That sounds like one of those things. But, you know, on a more positive note, I can report that. So I've had fully self-driving for all of the 8 years that I purchased it on the very first vehicle, which was 2016. So it's now 25. Actually, last month was the 8-year anniversary. And then I've upgraded twice. So I've had another vehicle, and then this last one, which I bought almost 3 years ago. And each time I've got the fully self-driving. But only in the latest update, which only came out about 3 weeks ago, have I been comfortable using the fully self-driving, like on a regular basis, to go around town and go on the course. It was always pretty good on the highway. But in the city, if you turned it on and the car was driving you around the city and you got to a traffic circle, for example, you just were holding your breath and praying that it didn't do something crazy, right? And now it's much, much better. So it's to the point now where I very seldom have to interrupt it. Occasionally I do. One of the things that's a little bit off about it is it doesn't seem to select the right lane sometimes, so I'll intervene and move it into a better lane. But left turns are good now. It goes around the traffic circle now. So what they did was they offered so this costs money, obviously. I think I paid $8,000 for it as an extra, and I think the latest number to buy it outright is $12,000. But the new thing now is to rent it. So I think it's like $79 a month or something like that to rent it, so you can turn it on. And there must be a minimum commitment in there of a few months. But what they did was they said to everybody that you can have it for free for a month. So they just started that after the latest update. So that was about 2 weeks ago. And so everybody's driving around in these Teslas with this fully self-driving thing and trying it out. So if you see a Tesla wandering all over the place, it's probably because the computer's driving the Tesla rather than the person, or maybe the other way around, right? I don't know.
Well, Apple has bailed out of the autonomous car business.
Yes.
And also watches. So they laid off 600 people. Now they say they're going to make a domestic robot so you can have a Rosie like in the Jetsons.
Well, you know, the thing about AI, we talked about AI for quite a while there. What people haven't really cottoned on to, I think, is that Tesla and Elon Musk have been, they've been doing AI for years now. So this whole fully self-driving thing, originally, they had people sort of entering into the computer, into the software, lines of code that would tell it what to do. If you come to this situation and there's these people walking across the street, stop the car, you know, don't run into the people, and then, you know, so on and so forth. You know, millions and millions of lines of computer programming code. And now, of course, all that's in there. But now what they're doing is they're using AI, or they call it a neural network. They don't call it AI. And what they're doing is that the cameras in the car are taking in all the situations and seeing how the car responds, seeing if the driver intervenes, and learning from the experience of that. And nobody else in the world, as far as I know, has got anything like that. So there's, you know, you got to have a few million cars on the road, and then you got to have people that are driving the cars. And I think that's why they rolled out free, fully self-driving for a month or two, to get additional input into the computers that are learning from the experience of all these things. So eventually, hopefully, the computer will make it even better. And but it's pretty good now, and I think it's probably better in the U.S. because they've got almost all of their learning was probably done in the U.S. with U.S. traffic signals and U.S. traffic stop signs and stuff like that. But and I don't know. I haven't tried it when the snow is, you know, a foot thick on the ground. I don't suppose it works all that great at that time. And then, of course, in a rainstorm, does it work in a rainstorm? I don't know. So it's still got a ways to go. But practical applications of AI, a fully automated electric vehicle that could drive around without a driver and could come, if you just call for it on your app on your phone, within a few minutes and take you to where you want to go, would be amazing. Most people wouldn't need to own a car, right? So that would be, you'd have all these cars out, they'd be, instead of being used 10% of the time, they'd be in use 80-90% of the time. They just have to stop for a while to get charged up, but it would change the world.
Hilliard, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Nice to talk to you again.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark and Hilliard Macbeth. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from the Director of Marketing for Recycleco, Tony Mitchell. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. My guest is Tony Mitchell, Director of Marketing for Recycleco. Tony, welcome back to Company Showcase.
Hey, Jim, it's great to be back.
What's the latest on Recycleco's Taiwan joint venture?
Things are going well. The team, both here in Vancouver and on the ground in Taiwan, are moving the ball ever closer to our end goal of having a 2,000 metric ton a year battery recycling and upcycling plant operational in Taichung late next year. But, you know, I know from the multiple conversations we've had with investors, vendors, and increasing number of interested parties of late, that everyone is keen to see us become a company with battery recycling operations around the globe ASAP. But the reality is big, ambitious plans such as ours take time, especially as the battery industry is largely still committed to a highly inefficient way of currently handling their battery waste. So it's like trying to turn around an ocean liner. It just doesn't turn on a dime. So while I understand everyone's frustration with the pace of our growth, our fluctuating stock price, et cetera, one thing keeps me focused and excited after all these years of development for our relatively near-term future, our joint venture in Taiwan and how we're rolling it out. It's important for our listeners to keep in mind that how we move forward with our first joint venture plant, you know, will set the template for all future operations. So naturally, there will be a lot more work involved with getting this first modular plant set up and operational than it will require for subsequent plants. And while we are focused on getting the plant designed and built on our side and working closely with the team in Taichung, our listeners need to realize that this new joint venture called the Recycleco Zenith Battery Materials Technology Corporation, which is a mouthful, is moving forward in tandem at a great pace. In fact, James Fang, who's head of this first joint venture, is highly proactive in leveraging business relationships he's established over decades of working within Asia. So in anticipation of our plant being operational late next year, James is already having high-level meetings with major potential battery production partners in Asia to line up feedstock and process their battery waste materials when we're ready. So his goal, as well as ours, is to make sure that once our $25 million clean spot plant is commissioned, we keep it up and running continuously and generating as much profit as possible.
It sounds like there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
Yes, Jim, there's a lot going on, and many items for our relatively small but mighty team to juggle. I know it may not seem like much is going on from the outside, but as our interim CEO, Richard Sadowski, recently told me, he doesn't want to put out any fluff information of no consequence. He's actively pursuing a number of big opportunities for the company, and going forward, he only wants to make announcements of a substantial nature. So we look forward to seeing the fruits of his labor. And as I've said many times before, but I'll restate it once again, we currently have 23 MOUs with major potential joint venture partners in the battery production and recycling space. And we continue to hear from the industry grapevine and from people we've tested and collaborated with that our patented closed-loop recycling and upcycling process is still the best they've seen, which we find very encouraging after pioneering, patenting, and proving we can recycle and upcycle lithium-ion battery waste for direct reuse in new battery materials since 2016, you know, way back when everyone in the battery industry said it was impossible. So when you keep those facts in mind, and that we're still in the very early days of the world's inevitable transition from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles, we remain highly confident in our future. However, you know, when you take into account all of the above and where our stock price currently sits, which puts us at around a $40 million market cap, and we have $17 million in the bank, Jim, listeners should please do their due diligence. And this is not investment advice, but our current stock price is a gift to those who can clearly see the lay of the land and wish to get involved. As a quick reminder, back in January of 2021, when we hit an all-time high of $2.85 a share, our longtime CEO, Larry Ray, used to say, "Today's highs are tomorrow's lows." And when I see how things are lining up for us as we make the challenging transition from being a junior mining exploration company to a major lithium-ion battery recycling technology partner, or player, within an industry that's on the cusp of massive growth, I can see just how prescient he was in pursuing the company's current path. So while we could certainly do without the various external factors we have no control over, you know, I still couldn't be more excited to be involved with helping our team and our partners achieve our goal of becoming the gold standard in lithium-ion battery recycling around the globe.
So I guess ideas are easy, but making them a reality is pretty tough.
Oh, yes. I completely agree with that, Jim. It's interesting. I was making notes for this podcast, and I happened to see a short video clip Elon recently reposted on X. It's just over 3 minutes of Steve Jobs talking about what it takes to bring an idea to fruition. He, you know, essentially summed up the challenges innovators such as ourselves go through, and I thought it apropos of where we stand and what we're going through. So I reposted it, and I encourage our listeners to watch the clip for themselves on our Twitter page, as they were very wise words and encouraging words from someone who's certainly been there, done that, albeit in a different industry.
Where is Recycleco traded, and how can people get more information about the company?
Certainly, Jim. We're traded on the TSX Venture under the ticker symbol AMY, on the OTCQB under the ticker symbol AMYZF, and the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under the ticker symbol ID4. And you can get more information on our website at recycleco.com.
Tony, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Tony Mitchell, Director of Marketing for Recycleco. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on April 11th.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.